S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is practicing social distancing and a whole lot of hand hygiene. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, in these straightened times, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you?
I'm very good, Captain. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well, thank you, sir. We are in a workplace and we are practicing the appropriate social distancing, but we did want to bring people to the podcast for as long as we can. At some point, this may need to go virtual. We might need to use a Zoom or a Skype or a something. I assume there's an Apple product we could be using if you made
yeah,
me.
If there's a good Apple product, we'll find one and we'll use it and you'll buy an Apple Mac and that'll be awesome. Yeah.
Mate, things aren't that desperate just yet. We'll see how we go.
This might actually turn out to be a good thing from a bad thing.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. All right. So, mate, look.
Enough of a tangent, right?
Well, that's all we do. If we didn't have tangents, people would wonder what podcast they were listening to. Mate, all about coronavirus again this week. And we will say again, we'll do a bit of coronavirus referencing, a bit of kind of what's new, what's news, what we're thinking. And then we'll get on to your questions. As I said last time, you know, hopefully this is useful for our listeners. I assume it is. Obviously, people looking to find out what to buy, what to sell, what not to own, how to think about the markets right now. And of course, it's all about coronavirus. There's simply nothing going on, or almost nothing going on around and outside that, right? It's all coronavirus related. So let's start from the top. And I'll just give you a grab bag of stuff that we've had in the last 7 days, and then we can kind of work out what's next. Now, as with last week, we're recording this on Thursday morning. So again, whatever's happened since then, by the time you're listening to this, you will know it, but we don't yet know it. I hope it's good news. Mate, so the big news is probably, this is almost bizarre, I have to say. I didn't realize this was the case. Apparently, yesterday, so Tuesday and Wednesday were positive days. Share prices were up. It's the first time we've had two consecutive days of share price rises in 5 weeks, which is, I mean, it almost, just law of averages, right? Even in the worst scenario, you think we would have had at least two consecutive days at some point in the last 25, but we hadn't until yesterday. So I guess that's something. We did see the largest rise in the US S&P since 1932 on, I think it was Monday night our time, or maybe Tuesday night our time. I'm losing my days. The US announced a $2 trillion with a T stimulus package. That's another sort of, you know, piece in the puzzle. We've seen increased social distancing and frankly lockdown in New Zealand. Lots and lots of individual bits and pieces. We've seen increased some degree of increased restrictions here, although they were kind of, you know, the 30-minute haircuts thing got repealed pretty quickly. Every job apparently is essential, and we also know, of course, and this is to be very serious for a second. Not that this isn't serious, but hundreds of thousands of people looking to be out of work at some point pretty soon. So lots going on. Maybe I can just get you to reflect on some of your, I won't say highlights, but what have you found most important, most worthwhile, most interesting over the last 7 days or so?
Ooh, that's a hard question. You give me all the, you know, you just did the prelude and you just...
Absolutely.
You just threw me under the bus.
Mate, that is what I'm here for. That is absolutely what I'm here for.
Just threw me under the bus.
All care, no responsibility.
I think the stimulus packages are... You know, pretty much everybody is doing what, like about 10% of GDP as roughly as stimulus, it seems. Like, you know, I think Germany also had a huge stimulus package that they've announced.
Okay, I missed that.
And yeah, I think between the news of the American stimulus package and the Australian stimulus package, those are two things probably our newspapers actually picked up. I think this got left behind. So I think Germany's also announced a huge... Yeah, so lots of stimulus all around to basically... nurse the economy back. Every economy is suffering, so that I think there is no doubt about that. I think the worst hit I think are workers in these businesses. A lot of small to medium scale businesses, cafes, restaurants, you know, dry cleaners, you know, the odd shop around the corner, all those guys, you know, are hit. And it's not just in Australia, but everywhere. So that is a problem, you know, and depending upon the economy, this could account for 20% of, you know, the economy to 30% of the economy, depends, you know.
Man.
So it's a big problem.
Isn't it?
And that's why, you know, we are talking about unprecedented stimulus. Social distancing, I guess, is increasing everywhere. Lots of different countries have announced, as you said, increased stringent social distancing. They're all hoping to sort of flatten the curve and, I guess, then, you know, kickstart the economy again, slowly but surely. From the market action, actually, is very interesting in my mind.
Right.
And it's interesting because you know, we've had some of the fastest declines that we have seen in, I guess, in the last maybe 30, 40 years, right?
I've heard, and I haven't verified this, it's the fastest decline of this size ever. So it's not, okay. it's not the biggest, but it's apparently the fastest.
The fastest, apparently. Right. So the speed. Yep. So, I mean, some of that could just be because of technology, right? I mean, yeah. you know, now you can trade very quickly. The high-frequency traders can trade very quickly. There's a lot of ETF in the market. So a lot of things happen. Yeah. A lot of money flows very quickly. So that you know, it has felt really sharp and yeah. fast.
It's also one of these, this is probably the first crash I can remember. I mean, the flash crash, although not the flash crash, but Black Monday in 87, the market fell 25% in a single day. So that was kind of, you know, that was absolutely far and away the biggest, most shocking single day's trade.
Yeah.
But I think to some degree, to my mind anyway, this is because the physical reality of the world, the virus has unfolded so incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
You know, the GFC kind of was a rolling unfolding of bad news. This one's gone from zero to 100 pretty much in, I mean, effectively weeks, right? Like
yeah.
you can trace back with hindsight and say, okay, well, the first report was back here. So it was January 9, I think, or something like that. I mean, it's been going effectively for 2 months or 2.5 months now. But realistically, the point where we all went, oh my God, was about February 20.
Yeah.
And that has been I think we've gone from this could be trouble to this is bad to we're locking down everything
yeah.
in 5 weeks, which I think is why to some degree that the financial markets have followed the physical world.
Yeah. The reason I think the volatility of the market is interesting, or I shouldn't say interesting, but rather it's something to think about, because you know, we had so many days of, you know, down days, and then we've had a couple of, you know, big up days. What I find interesting is the up days almost appears to be in response to A, lockdown, which means A, we are doing something about it, and B, stimulus, which means again, we are doing something about it.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the good news. But
yeah, right.
What I think, you know, and I'm again, this is hard to know.
Yep.
It's hard to know how much of the bad news actually has been factored, has not been factored, right? Because as of now, we haven't yet
yep.
seen anything go belly up,
yes,
right?
Yes.
There hasn't been a calamity. Yes. There hasn't been a big name that has gone out of business. So there hasn't been a big name that has, you know, had to dilute itself like heavily. Mm. None of that has actually happened,
yep.
right? We are still sort of in this consumer world where we know that the consumer is going to be hurting because a lot of people are basically going to be hurting and therefore they're not going to be spending, right?
Yeah.
But what about a lot of stuff that's actually already come to a grinding halt
yeah.
and there's no money actually flowing through those businesses, right? So I think that has not happened. So that, I think, is the interesting aspect. Again, you know, the market is a forward-looking machine, so yeah. it looks forward. It's not accurate, but it does yeah. look forward, right?
That's a really good point. Let's kind of sit on that for a bit, because we all know kind of what's happening in the physical world. We have, yeah, but nothing, as you say, has kind of gone badly yet in terms of released results. We don't know new unemployment stats. We don't know, at least with any detail, the total number of people out of work. We don't know the share of GDP that's been lost because of these shutdowns. So the market's kind of looking forward and going, I reckon this is going to be ugly. And so let's sell the market off by a third, give or take, and it depends on the day because it's been so stupidly volatile. You know, that's the forward-looking element, right? As yeah. you say, to some degree, the market's saying, right, this is going to get bad. We reckon some you know, guesstimate means about a third is about right
yeah.
at this stage. Now, it's also true that, you know, it wasn't a third up front. It was 2%, then 3%, then 5%, yeah. then plus 1, then minus 6, then plus 4, then minus 12. You know, those moves have been, to some degree, the market coming to grips with this and trying desperately to, as you say, look forward and price in, to use the jargon,
yeah.
the bad news. The problem, as you say, is we don't know yet which companies, how badly, how long, how deep, how much unemployment, how much GDP growth, the flow-on effects from that. So GDP yeah. slows, and then at that point something else happens. That's all the unknown. This is where investing, frankly, it's always hard, right? You can never tell the future. Maybe it's, I don't even know if it's harder necessarily in downturns, but it certainly is more emotionally taxing in the downturns. But there is exactly that story of, like, has the market factored in enough decline? Too much decline, not enough decline. That one we'll know, of course, in hindsight. It depends on what happens from here, but that's exactly why it's so uncertain.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, this psychological plays on people's mind. It actually plays on my mind, and then I have to sort of sit down and do a little bit of a math to, you know, remind myself. So one of the things I want to talk about here is the market declines from, say, you know, 100 points, 30%. Yep. You're down to, say, 70 points.
Yes.
Just, you know, assume that is your index. Now, if the market goes up 30%, it actually does not go back to the same point. It actually needs to go up a lot more to actually go exactly. back to the 100 right. point.
So right. it falls by 30%, it's going up 50% to get back to
exactly,
where it started.
Exactly. Yeah. And so therefore, you might have these days where it seems like, oh, the market went up a lot. Yeah, it's actually right. still. So then the market actually falls yeah. very quickly.
Yeah.
And then it makes these slow climbs.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, again, that psychologically, you need to remember that. So it might look like, oh, okay, I'm, you know, if somebody's thinking about buying something and they say, oh, you know, market fell by 30%, now it's, yeah. you know, up by 10%, and therefore I've missed out. Not really, because...
Yeah.
You know, 10% rise from 70 points is only like, you know, you've gotten to like 77,
yeah.
right? You're still, you know, if you're thinking in terms of the discount relative to when stuff started, you know, mm-hmm. going bad. Anyways, that's something to think about. But
yeah, it's a good point. The other good thing, if you like, is that if you own a stock like I do, some of the travel stocks I own that have been down, you know, 60 or 70%, when they fall another 10%, it's just not quite as painful as it was in the first 10% because the shares are already down so much that, you know, 10% from $2 is different to 10% from $20. So I don't know if that's better or worse, but at least I know the dollars are different to the percentages that, you know, I only jest almost in some form of gallows humor because that's just kind of the situation that we find ourselves in. But I take that point.
Yeah. And I'll make one last point and then I think we can talk about other things. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting is as investors for us to think about, similar to many, like, you know, small to medium scale businesses, The issue is not really about business prospects
right.
over the long term. The issue is really about business prospects over the short term because many companies wouldn't have the cash
yes.
or the ability
yes.
to
yes.
tide over,
yes.
Say, a six-month downturn.
Yeah.
And this is not just true for, you know, SMBs or cafes, restaurants and things like that. They're definitely going to be hurting. Or, you know, the hairdressing, mm-hmm. You know, the barber salon or the nails and, you know, beautician store or the physiotherapist. This is actually true for in the listed market too.
Yep. Yep.
For a lot of companies, the main issue right now is just the ability to, you know, so it's really a question of, you know, do you have enough cash?
Right, right, right.
And can you reduce enough of your cash expenditure or cash burn
yep.
so that you can tide through? And in the market has an interesting dynamic when the market starts suspecting that cash might be a problem. And this is right. this is like a vortex,
that's
you know,
right.
this is like a vortex in which a company which is otherwise good gets stuck and then this becomes a problem, right?
Yep.
It becomes a problem because the market recognizes, oh, you don't have enough cash.
Yep.
And therefore, it knows that you're going to need cash and starts discounting your price. The more you discount the price, the harder it becomes actually for this company to raise at any sustainable level, right? So if yep. a company yep. has to, you know, raise cash at roughly say 50% of, you know, or 60% or 70% discount,
yeah, yeah.
basically it can grow in earnings as much as it wants,
yeah.
but on an earnings per share basis, it is basically stuffed.
Right, right, right.
right? So I think that's something again, and that's happening and unfolding at this point.
Right. So just put some numbers as to why that's true, mate. I'll try and add something. If you've got a $100 million market cap and you need to raise $10 million, then you have to give away 10% of the ownership to somebody else. If the Bitcoin market knows you're in trouble and your market cap falls to $20 million, but you still need to raise $10 million of cash, you've got to give half the company away to raise the same cash. So that's why, to your point, you know, you're raising a lower share price, which is not the issue necessarily in and of itself. It's the fact that you have to raise the same amount of capital, so you're giving away more of the company to raise the cash you need. And that's to your point where even if earnings improve meaningfully, earnings go up 20%, if you give away 50% of the company, you're still behind on a per share basis.
Yeah, and one last comment, you know, on abstraction. So the final thing is that, you know, as an investor, I think we tend to look at, say, market cap of a company and think, oh, this is a large company.
Right.
But, you know, a large company may actually not have enough cash.
Yeah.
And then they could still be in trouble because they don't have enough cash, right? So, you know, the company's market cap is almost irrelevant
yes.
at this point,
yes,
right?
Yes.
What you really need to see is how much cash do they have relative to the cash burn.
Correct. And that's the hard part, man. I've been asked, I'm sure you've been asked regularly, you know, which company, what, where, how. The hardest part with this is that you can, it's easy to find the ones, well, not even easy. There might be a small number of companies who are never, ever going to be in trouble because they've got so much cash that there's almost no circumstance which they burn it all before things get better. But that's probably, what, 1%, 0.5% of companies in the ASX, even globally. They're just, you know, there is a very, very few who almost show no, there's almost no potential for them to go broke. The rest is a question of, and, you know, we've tried to kind of codify this to some degree, but it's a question of you know, adding together the rate of cash, sorry, the fall off in revenue, how fast that fall off is, how long that revenue fall off lasts, how far you can cut your costs, and then how quickly revenue picks back up again.
Yeah.
Because that's all the maths, right? You can know how much cash a company's got now, but does revenue fall in half for 3 months? Does it fall 100% for 6 months? Are costs almost exactly fixed, or can you get 90% of your costs? You can make some educated guesswork around it, but there are so many variables here. It's just incredibly difficult to do with any degree of accuracy. There's some that are absolutely obviously in dire straits. There are some that are very few that are absolutely obviously or almost obviously going to be okay. And we can never guarantee anything on the upside, of course. But there's a whole heap in between, the vast, vast, vast bulk that are just a question of, well, I guess it depends how long and what the banks do.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the issue, I was having without, again, going to specifics, I think is a lot of companies, I think that it's the same, it's the human psychology at play.
Yeah.
And if companies have not seen hard times and they've not really done disaster planning,
yep,
then they have also, life is great, life is good, and therefore they've continued, with their normal ways. And then that basically means that you effectively are left with less cash on the balance sheet. And then if you're left with less cash on the balance sheet, that's where it becomes trouble. So yeah, I think there are absolutely lots of companies, I think, in that side. And I think consumer discretionary especially is probably the red hot zone in my view, because yeah. I mean, that's where a lot of things come into play, right? I mean, a lot of things are closed, right? Yes. You can't do a lot of things right now.
That's right.
If you can't do a lot of things, well, even if you have the money, you can't spend it. So money is basically not moving.
Correct.
And a lot of people, then there's sentiment issues, right? If people don't have jobs, they're not going to be spending because they don't have jobs.
Right.
So these things take time to get fixed. I think consumer discretionary is really an area where if somebody's looking to actually, something might look cheap, but it could be actually a value trap because, again, we really need to know how they'll be able to, tide over the next time. Again, what I'm basically saying is, it's a broad stroke statement, right? Yeah. That doesn't mean that if there are 100 companies, there's not one. There would be one or two that'll be perfectly placed.
Right.
To, sail through this and come out shining on the other side.
Well, that's the thing, right? So right now, so many of these companies have been beaten down so badly. The ones that survive are going to be phenomenal wealth creators over the next 2 years. I mean, if you could know with any certainty the businesses that are going to get through this, you're looking at really, really huge gains. The problem is, as you say, we don't know how many, we don't know what proportion. We don't really even know at this stage how to handicap those odds by company, by sector, by industry. Because this is unprecedented. I mean, the lockdown length itself will be probably the primary driver of their survivability, right?
Yeah. I think the only caveat I'll add, the ones that are obviously going to survive, the ones that you could actually basically, close your eyes and say, this is surviving, they actually have not been sold off as much.
And that's that's exactly the point.
So what you really is, you have to go basically through the garbage bin.
Exactly.
And you go through the dustbin and then try to find the ones, that's incredibly hard. in the dustbin, among the dirt, you get your hands dirty and then you might find one or two. There's going to be, there's absolutely going to be stuff that's going to be making a lot of money at these prices.
Yep.
And there's absolutely lots of things that are actually going to go belly up or actually never going to make money because, they're going to be substantially diluted.
Yeah, it's huge. So look, I think my last point before we move on to some of the mailbag stuff, mainly got other things on Corona, is just I want to re-emphasize, I've been doing it recently, last week or so, with different kind of public or otherwise, appearances, probably sounds like a very wanky word, probably is. You know what I mean? In all the different forums that we've been talking, I've been emphasizing in lots and lots of times the value of the portfolio itself, right? So this is, we have members, we have listeners, we have readers who will want to buy the stock that we think is best, or, which is the best stock right now, or which is the best stock to buy. The answer is almost certainly there isn't one stock, right? Particularly in, as you said, mate, the ones that are going to survive haven't fallen by definition. So there's no sort of slam dunk opportunity there. The ones that have fallen most and have the biggest chance of rebounding also have the biggest chance of going broke. So whichever approach you take as an investor, please, please, please make sure you have a portfolio, diversified portfolio, ideally at least 15 stocks, preferably 20, of companies that you just, you think overall are going to be market beaters, because when you're wrong, and you will be, as we will be, then we the portfolio itself is constructed to support that reality. And I think that's, for me, if there's one clear message out of here, the first is patience, the second is portfolio. Maybe there's another P, we can do it in three Ps at some point. But at least have a portfolio approach to your investing. Don't buy one stock you think is going to go well, no matter how good or otherwise it is, because you really are taking risks that you otherwise might not want to take. Just on that, mate, one last thought too from me on Corona generally, and it's about the market approach or the market size, or whatever you want to call it. Right now, so here's the thing. The market's off 30-something percent. I don't know what the numbers are right now from the February 20 highs. And at some point, you've got two choices right now, right? If the market bounces back, let's say at some point in the distant future, it comes back to be back level where it was in February. Let's just pick that, right? So let's say the market's down a third because it makes my maths easier. When it grows, it's going to grow 50% to go back to that level. Now, let's say it takes a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. It doesn't really matter how long for the purposes of this exercise. People are saying to us, hey, what about a company like, say, CSL, for example? It's down 13%. What a great price. And it may well be true, but if you think moving forward from here, if you can buy the market, so an index ETF, for example, and be up 50% when the market regains its current highs, and CSL goes back up by the amount it's fallen to its previous highs, you're actually going to get left behind with CSL compared to the market, no matter how good a quality that particular business is. And with that, we're talking about the particular business, it doesn't really matter which business it is, but just the idea that if you're buying one that's fallen a little bit because it's great, I don't think that's necessarily a terrible idea. Just be mindful that if you weren't buying it pre-crash, slump, fall, whatever you want to call this thing, crisis, but you're buying it now because you think now is finally a good price, the market is actually much cheaper than the company in relative terms, and if and when they both go back to their previous highs, the market's going up a lot more than some of those businesses. So again, by all means, own the business. By all means, be comfortable and sleep at night. I think they're great things to do. Just be mindful that if you're buying it because you think this is the once in a lifetime opportunity to make some great money, I would argue that in most cases, if and when the market gets back to where it was, it's likely to actually do better than those stocks from here, just because when they both go back to normal and that pessimism / downturn impact is removed, the maths doesn't support the big small fallers beating the market from here. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I take a slightly different tack on that.
Sure.
So it is true that a lot of big names would not, or big names and obvious mm-hmm. ones that are not going to die are not going to fall as much. That is definitely true.
Yep.
There will be, of course, other businesses that are just going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, babies thrown away with sort of the bathwater, so to speak. Some of them might be in the smaller end. Some of them might be, you know, because people's sentiment have changed to safety. So, for example, people might have decided that, well, you know, in such crazy times, the only thing I want to hold is like, you know, CSL and maybe something else. And that boosts the price of CSL up, CSL back up, just, you know, more people rushing to buy CSL. Yeah. So there will be companies which would have plenty of cash, which would have ability to weather the storm for, you know, a year, maybe more, which are still going to be bringing in cash that would actually be really cheap.
Yeah.
So, you know, a diversified portfolio of those would also, I think, can do well. So, I mean, you know, you have to be, if you're looking for bargains, then you have to be a bit careful.
Yeah.
I actually don't mind the idea of buying the market as a whole. I think that's you know, that's another strategy that you could buy. But, you know, if you're looking to outperform the market, then you'd have to buy other things. But but I think that's a pretty, you know, good way to make money.
I'm not saying people shouldn't buy those companies at all, by the way. I'm just being, you know, for those who are buying it because they think they get there some all of a sudden fantastic money to be made. If you're buying at 13% ago for CSL, for example, great thing to do and knock yourself out. If it's cheaper now, then you love it, and then even better. If you thought it was going to beat the market already, that's fine. Just from here, you're kind of giving the market a head start. Or, you know, on the way down, you do better if you already owned it, so well done. But from here back, by the time if you're putting $100 in both now, I would, a CSL would have to do double duty, triple duty to get back to the same percentage gains that the market will do almost by definition as it recovers.
Yeah, I actually 100% agree with that sort of that line of thinking. In fact, I would actually not be buying anything that has done extremely well in this market. because right. by definition, that's basically a flight to safety sort of thing. You know, as a rule of thumb, I actually would not touch any of those yep. right now.
Now, I do want to say, mate, for what it's worth, I actually agree with you, except I don't want to discourage people entirely because, yeah, they may feel better sleeping at night with a CSL in their portfolio, even if it's going to lose to the market. If that's the case for someone listening, then I think that's great. They absolutely should do that. So I don't want to discourage people outright from buying those companies. But given you have the choice of either buying the market or trying to beat the market, because they really should be the only two choices you usually would want to take, particularly if you get the market as a diversified investment. If you're buying an index ETF and getting thousands of companies, a diversified portfolio at a cheaper price, and if you believe the market will recover, then you can do that. That should be your base case, right? If you're not going to do as well as that, then I think that would be a tough argument to say, I want to invest as well as I can and buy the market. If you say, look, I just want to sleep at night. I don't care if CSL underperforms the market. At least I like the company. I know I've got it. That's completely cool. That's not what we do at The Motley Fool. Generally speaking, we'd say buy an ETF instead because at least you get the market return. Actively choosing something you don't think will beat the market is a little bit self-defeating, except, as I said, if it's a sleep at night thing, then I'm not going to criticize anybody for doing it.
Cool.
All right, mate. Let's get on with one of our favorite segments. Our favorite segment?
The favorite segment.
Mailbag time.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, we got so much mailbag. Listeners, if you've sent us some questions, please stick with us. We're getting more than we can answer at the moment. So we will at some point actually have to start rationing the answers to this stuff. We do our best to answer as many as we can possibly get to. But because we get more every week than we can answer, if your question is still on the list, please feel free to re-ask it if you want. And we'll do our level best. All right, let's start here. Hi, Scott and Doc. Avid listener of the pod as well as the US sister pod and Rule Breaker Investing as well. I'm turning 37 tomorrow. Happy birthday, Colin. Mate, sorry, that was yesterday as we're recording, 2 days ago as you listen to this. Happy birthday, mate. And bought my first stock in 2014. So this is the first major crash I've invested through. Mate, I hope you're holding your nerve. I was a member of Share Advisor for a few years, but I'm now a member of Pro. Colin. You're leaving my service going to Docs. It doesn't exactly endear me to you, mate, just quietly. My portfolio has gone from plus 25 to minus 20 in a few weeks. I know the feeling. My question is the only foolish one at the moment. How do I decide when to buy more? I have a considerable amount of cash against my mortgage, and so I'm looking to invest a reasonable chunk of that into the market after it has bottomed. My thinking is we need some certainty around the impact and duration of the virus before we will bottom out. Very interested to hear your thoughts. I'm going to throw this to you, Doc. He's a pro member. It's your responsibility. I get to talk.
Well, happy birthday, Colin. Okay, great question. This is a question that everybody asks.
Yeah,
and actually, this is the hot question. Here's the thing, right? I'm also trying to figure out when the bottom is. The problem is, we'll all know when the bottom is. In like 2 years from now, we'll know where the bottom was because right. You know, everybody knows the bottom for the GFC. I don't mean that as a joke or as I'm not poking fun. But I think like intuitively, we all want to know when things are going to bottom out. The twofold issues, like, you know, there are many ways to think about this. You could say, well, you know, stuff is going to get worse because, you know, we have not yet flattened, for example, you know, if you think about ASX stocks, well, we have not yet flattened the infection rate in Australia, and therefore, you know, we really don't know when, you know, things are going to go back to, you know, somewhat of a semblance of a normal. But the market also knows that.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yep.
And the moment these, you know, the curve of infections starts flattening, well, it'll be everywhere on the news. Everybody would know about that, and the market knows that too. Right. So I think trying to exactly pick the bottom is really, really hard.
Can we say impossible?
Huh?
Can we say impossible?
Yeah, I think it's impossible. Well, somebody might luck out and pick one. So,
right.
I guess what you could say is this, that you could say that, well, the markets have fallen a lot. So therefore, at least on that basis, it is relatively cheaper. That's number one. Number two is, you know, if you're a pro member, what we did is we did a review of all the stocks we own. I don't know whether you're a member of Pro 2 or Pro 1, but if you're a member of both, then for both of those portfolios, what we did is we did a review. We also, you know, recently advised some buy ideas. So what we have done in that portfolio, and what have you know, what I personally do is, you know, when things start looking like they are good value, and mm-hmm. good value in the sense that, you know, if and really at a very high level, I'm looking at it on a couple of different axes, right? So one of them is, does the company have enough cash? And we just talked about this in the beginning of the podcast. Does the company have enough cash to weather through this? That's number one. Number two is, does the company actually do something that is essential, right? So if it has a service that we think other people are going to continue, I mean, we would expect some customers to leave, some customers to churn out. But, you know, some things are just essential. Like, you know, if you just need it. It's like almost like your internet, right? I mean, your internet is not going to be cut. You're not going to cut your internet unless you absolutely have to. Like, would some people lose their NBN connection? I'm sure they will. But it'll be one of the last things that people will be looking to cut, right? So I think...
Right.
So I think you can apply that sort of judgment and that judgment on companies and what they do and what they provide and services they provide. So and so you look at that. And then you can sort of think, well, you know, let's say in a year's time, we start getting back to normal. Yes, this is going to take some time to get back to normal, but you know, look forward 3, 4, 5 years. Do you think, you know, what would be the earnings be, say, 5 years from now? Again, it's a guess. It's never going to be perfect, but you can make an estimate. And, you know, a very simple thing you could do as well. Based on that estimate, you can apply a multiple, which you think is reasonable for a company of the quality that you're looking at. Mm. And then you could estimate whether or not it looks discounted to you enough or not. You know, and you, I would think that there are a number of companies right now which would appear, which are solid, which can actually, you know, sustain through this and which are discounted. And, you know, I would add to them. So basically, I'm not a big fan of going all in at one time. And the reason I don't do that is it's just psychological. If I was a robot and I didn't have any, you know, psychological biases to deal with, then, you know, it would make sense. If I've got a lot of money sitting around, then I would look to deploy them pretty quickly on those ideas that I think are, you know, going to be winners, right? Yep. So if I have got 15, 20 ideas that I think are going to be winners, I've got a lot of money sitting around, well, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe the stocks go up tomorrow, maybe they go down, right? So if I think they're going to make money, I would deploy. But because I'm a human being and I'm going to probably crib if, you know, the stocks went down further, what I like to do is I actually deploy it slowly. And the way I justify that, and again, not, as I said, if I was a robot, this would not apply. But the way I justify this is, if I have a substantial amount of money invest in the market and the market goes up, well, those things that I own are actually gone up. And therefore, I'm happy. Right? If the market actually goes down, then if I have some amount of cash available and I apply that to the market, then I feel like, well, I invested at a lower price and therefore I'm going to do better in the future. That also makes me happy. Right? So a lot of these things that one does, portfolio management is a lot about logic, but it's also a lot about behavioral management.
And,
and you have to really manage your own behavior so that you don't make those mistakes. And, you know, I've actually felt reasonably, you know, there have been days when I've felt very anxious, but at the same time, I felt reasonably comfortable this time because, you know, I felt that, well, you know, I felt a little bit in control, which is a funny thing to say because you're really not in control, but you want to feel in control
because that
helps you make better decisions. So that's sort of my framework. Invest. I'm investing, adding to things that I think are very good bets over the next 5 years, and with that sort of time frame, look at cash, look at the business, think about the business's sustainability. And I'd also say this, there are going to be, as you know, as we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, they're going to be what I call, you know, picking through the garbage bin ideas too.
Yeah.
And I think actually that is, you know, some of those garbage bin ideas are actually going to make a lot of money because they're going to be dirt cheap.
Right.
And maybe a little basket of that too makes sense. You know, this is again all about how you want to deploy your cash, you know, what sort of, you know, I think of these as sleeves, you know, hey, okay, you know, some, you know, you can call them small ball, long shot ideas, but you know, if even a little bit of money, but with, but on some of these long shot ideas, you're actually likely to come up ahead, right? Yep. So it's a little bit of manage yourself, manage your thinking, and I think again. I can't give you any direct answers. I just told you what basically how I am thinking about it. Nice. And then you need to think in your context. And I'm sure Scott would have something much better to add.
Not much better at all. I'm going to throw a slightly different topic or different approach to it. I think knowing your limitations, or at least knowing, to Doc's point about temperament, temperament's super important, right? Buffett himself has said, for all of his attributes, the most important is temperament. So being able to control that either actively or even passively by doing things like pre-commitment. Dollar cost averaging is a wonderful way to do it, right? Because the money's there, it gets invested every month in whatever your best ideas are. If that is something that helps you just literally invest when markets are high or markets are low, when they're in between, not having to think about it, worry about it, just removing that issue can be, to Doc's point, buying in thirds is one option. Dollar cost averaging is another version of the same kind of thing. You just put your money in your best idea every month or every quarter or every fortnight, whatever it is you're going to save. That can be particularly useful. The other thing I'll just say is about picking the bottom is, here's the thing, right? My general thought right now is, the ASX has always gone on to make new highs. And when it does again, I think it will. There's no guarantees in investing. I'm legally not allowed to make guarantees, and ethically we wouldn't ever try and give a guarantee for stuff like that because, hey, who knows? We can't control circumstance. But if the ASX is going to go on to re-reach, that's not a word, if it's going to revisit that high of February 20 again, then if it's down a third, it's going to be about 50% by the time we get there. Now, let's say it takes 3 years. Right, that is a return of 16% a year. Now, it's less because you've got a compounder, but just, maybe it's 14%, Doc. Maybe it's 13%, whatever it is. That's a very good return if it takes. Now, if it takes 5 years, well, that's a 9% return, which is not great, but still pretty okay. And so for me, I'm not saying go all in necessarily right now. I'm not saying this is the bottom or this is the time to put all your cash to work. Doc's point is absolutely right. And if you've got a lump sum, I would absolutely put it in over a number of months just for the purely psychological benefit of doing it slowly, as Doc said, if the market falls, you get to buy a cheaper price. If the market rises, you made some money, you get to as an individual. And even though it sounds like I'm, there's some smoke and mirrors here, of course we all know it's the same thing. But trust me, psychologically, emotionally, it does make a huge difference. So I'd be happy to buy now. I would spread it over months if I could. But my general starting point for most investors, particularly if you're a hyper-competitive investor who desperately wants to beat the market and you want to play the game, I wouldn't say don't do it. I would say be careful, like margin, right? Everyone thinks they'll use margin loans carefully. Ask yourself now. We were asked these questions 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Should you use margin? Oh, how bad can it get? You know what? if you had a 75% LVR and the market falls a third, you've actually been wiped out. That you have literally been wiped out right now. Even if your LVR was 50%, you've lost three quarters of your money, Doc. I can't do the maths in reverse in my head.
Whatever it is, it's pretty bad.
Right. And so you kind of yes, you think you're the person who can pick the bottom. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. If you missed it, and you don't buy because you missed it, and then you wait for the next fall or something else, the cost of that could be stratospheric compared to just actually investing maybe 5, 10, 15% higher than the bottom just because you wanted to get on with it. So I would personally just get on with it, particularly across the market. If you're picking individual stocks and you're particularly trying to be clever about the bounce back stuff, there is extra risk there. But again, on a portfolio level, I'm happy just to say, look, the market's low. I think it'll regain those highs. I think it'll go higher than the last lot of highs eventually. So if it's a 60, 70, 80% return over 7 years, again, those numbers aren't going to be stratospheric, but gee, it's worth, you won't be sorry you invested if I'm right and if the market does go on to reach and then exceed those previous highs. Any more from that, mate?
No, sir.
Cool. Next one from fantastic. Paul. Paul says, hi, guys, long-time listener and subscriber and a Charter Pro subscriber. Awesome, Paul. Thank you. Who has benefited greatly from all the insights from everyone at The Motley Fool Australia. So first of all, a huge thanks. Thank you, mate. For the first time, I'm seriously considering allocating a sizable portion of my SMSF to an ETF, here's some jargon, self-managed super fund, to an exchange-traded fund, and just letting it sit there. I have previously ignored PRO's ETF recommendations. The ETF I'm interested in is called FANG Plus. There's more details. It's an ETF securities product. It has started trading on the ASX and mirrors the FANG Plus ETF that's traded in the US. I guess the benefit is the exchange rate raffle risk is negated. However, this is not a biggie for me. Basically, it's 10 companies equally invested, rebalanced, and populated quarterly according to a proprietary filter. It has comfortably outperformed the net on the US market over the last 6 years. Current companies are Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, Alibaba, Baidu, Nvidia, Tesla, and Twitter. Doc, these companies seem right up your path as they can be considered growth companies. But would like both your thoughts. It's very kind of you, Paul, to at least include me in the conversation. These are some brilliant companies. However, could be considered risky due to the concentration. What could possibly go wrong? What say you? Cheers, Paul. Really cool question, Paul. Doc and I actually talked about this at DF a little while ago. Mm-hmm. So, Doc, I'm going to quickly restate. It is 10 companies, equally proportioned, rebalanced quarterly, according to a proprietary filter. So they pick 10 companies, they put 10% of the fund in those 10 companies, and they rebalance that back to 10% each every single quarter, including making changes to the list if they want to. So that's the ETF. We've talked a lot about US tech. We've talked a lot about the NASDAQ ETF based in Australia. What do you reckon about the FANG ETF?
Okay, before answering that, I want to actually directly answer something to Paul here.
Okay.
And that's because he said...
You're in trouble here, Paul.
Because he said he ignored Pro's ETF recommendations. You know, and the reason I want to... we talked about this. It's very easy to ignore. ETFs don't sound sexy, right? They don't sound great.
Exactly.
But there was, and we talked about this multiple times through multiple write-ups, that the reason we have those ETFs is actually twofold. The ETFs, one... they provide access to world-class companies, many world-class companies, many sectors that we actually can't find here on the ASX. So that's one reason.
Which gives you both diversification but also just straight out growth potential.
Exactly. So straight out growth potential. But the other thing that we talked about was the diversification aspect is if something happens, often what would happen, if something local happens, the Australian dollar takes a hit.
Yep.
In fact, on that scenario, your ETFs actually do really well because your ETF actually gets a dollar boost. Number two, if something even global happens, then too, the Australian dollar actually takes a hit because for obvious reason, flight to safety for the USD. So again, it's also a hedge in that sense. So you get growth, you get diversification, and you get a hedge.
Yep.
That is a brilliant combo to have. And not investing because it doesn't sound sexy, I think is just... it's not the right thing to do, I think. Mm. And so I'd encourage people to think about those ETFs more broadly as providing multiple things. Now, there are many ways to invest. There are hundreds of different ETFs. Some ETFs I wouldn't touch. But at Pro, we love those ETFs that we have in Pro One. Mm. I think those ETFs are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And we're very happy with them. So that's that. With respect to this one, I have mixed feelings about this. the reason I have mixed feelings about this, so these are fantastic companies. I actually own some of them. I have a quick count. One, two, so no, that's good. And Paul, you're going to just putting me out of trading of these, but that's okay. so I'm going to blame Paul
You don't have to name if you don't name the companies from here, mate, you're okay.
I can live without trading on these ones, and I've not traded on these ones. So I own Apple, I own Amazon. I actually recently thought about adding to Amazon, and because my wife said I should add to Amazon, and because my wife said I should add to Amazon, I didn't add to Amazon, which was not a good idea.
Mate, you should have already just quietly. You know better than that.
Yeah. so that was a mistake. I used to own Netflix, which I don't own anymore. Netflix has actually done wonderfully in this crisis because everybody's watching Netflix. Mm. Google, Google is a great company, but I pathologically don't like the company. So that's just my bias. Alibaba is, again, an interesting company. Baidu, I have reservations about. I have reservations about Nvidia. I own a lot of Tesla. I have no reservations about Tesla. And Twitter, actually, I have Twitter, but Twitter for me is more of an income position because I have what's called a covered call running on it. I either have a covered call running on it or some short puts running on it just as an income position. So I don't really... So my feeling with this thing is the problem is I like some of them and I'm not really a fan of some of the others. And with 10 stocks, you basically get a lot of concentration. So if these are 10 companies that you want to own, then, go for it. I think this 10 combo as a whole would likely beat the market. That's my hunch, my guess.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to pick one, I would actually pick the NASDAQ 100 over this one.
Okay.
Largely because I think it gives me a wider swath of companies. You still get the same sort of 10%-ish allocation, some of the large ones.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
I get some of the smaller ones as well. So Yeah. So I'll caveat that by saying that if you want a more higher allocations to, you know, Tesla, Nvidia, Amazon, you know, Alibaba. Alibaba actually, I think, is a really good company as well. This is a good combo. So yeah, I have mixed feelings again, but again, overall, I'll say this is okay. Not great, but okay.
Now, you're less critical about it, let me put it that way, than you were last time we talked about it.
Yeah.
Your issue in the past, and the issue I have with it, so I will put words in your mouth, and then you can feel free to spit them back out again, was that the quarterly rebalance means you don't get a chance to let your winners run on this stuff. And so, you know, if and people might have a hunch that you like Apple and Tesla, for example. If Tesla's going to go from its current price to $10,000 a share, which is one company's price target, but you get rebalanced all the way through, you still will get the kind of quarterly gains over time. But every time they cut back on that position, they're kind of, is it not a little bit of, I won't say any of these are weed companies necessarily, but it's not a little bit of kind of cutting your flowers and watering your weeds?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that. But that also happens with the index as well, right? Because again, it all depends on relative. Like really, if everything was increasing in sync, then, the index, you know, if you own NASDAQ 100 too, stuff is going to be sold off because, you know, something like, you know, if the Apple shares fall back right now, you're actually going to be selling off they're going to be selling off Apple to, you know, rebalance. So that's the problem. I invest directly, you know, but anybody's not investing directly, then, you know, ETFs. This is not bad. You know, again, I changed my mind largely because I think, you know, again, the reason I changed my mind is...
To make me look silly?
No, not that. So the thing is...
Not this time.
If somebody wanted higher exposure to... like if you buy NASDAQ 100, you'd get high exposure to things like, you know, Apple, Amazon, Google, and things like that, right? But if you want high exposure to those plus some of the other ones, then this gives you that, with the caveat that yes, they're going to be, you know, trimming stuff every quarter based on how things have moved. So I mean, and it has got Facebook, for example, in it. So you get some of the top plus. In a way, you could say that if you believe in these companies, then you're fine. But really the two companies that I have some issues with is Baidu,
right,
and Nvidia. Not Nvidia as a company. I just don't like the price yet for Nvidia, and the reason behind that is I just think the semiconductor industry overall is very cyclical, and there's a lot of exuberance sometimes that gets priced in because, you know, they were doing something in AI and stuff like that. And, you know, some of that stuff can work and, you know, they're GPU leaders and things like that. But I just think that, you know, its price seems a little high relative to the price of some of the other ones, which seems okay and good, right? So I think that's my reservation. And Baidu has been struggling for some time. So that's more specific comment is, like, Baidu has been struggling for some time. I have some issues with Nvidia. I actually have some issues with Netflix, but, you know, it could be that I'm actually wrong on Netflix because I sold my Netflix shares after many years, and I'm definitely wrong more often than not, I would like to think. So, I mean, you know, give or take here and there, it depends on, again, what you want to achieve, but it's probably not that bad. It's not great, but it's not that bad.
I'm gonna keep my original objection, even though you've made me look silly. No, I'm kidding. Here's the two things. I don't like the rebalance. I don't like rebalancing generally speaking. It's a great way to avoid excess volatility. It generally is a terrible way to let your winners run, in my view. I also think to some degree, the fact we know historically a lot of growth comes from the middle of the pack of companies that are then, you know, going to the lead, right? So if you think about the winners of today weren't the winners of 10 years ago. If you'd only bought the 10 top stocks of the S&P 500, even the NASDAQ 10 years ago, maybe not NASDAQ, you might know better than me. If you bought the top 10 US companies 10 years ago, they're not the top 10 companies anymore. And so I don't love the fact that you're only buying, you know, the biggest already in that group, in the tech space, which is still positive. I'd almost, to your point about the NASDAQ ETF, I'd like to have some exposure to the growing list of 10 through 30, for example, the ones that are, you know, the up-and-comers. I don't know the businesses well enough at all. You know them very well, but some of those businesses you've talked about in the past, some of the businesses that I don't necessarily know super well, but if they are going to be the leaders of tomorrow, not even necessarily the biggest companies, but have the biggest gains from here, it feels a little bit like buying the FANG. It's like buying the already blue chips rather than maybe a combination of those plus getting the benefit of the up-and-comers as they do grow.
Yeah, so I mean, and that was the point, I guess, you made it more eloquent. That was what I was actually saying is in favor of this lot, is that it has this mix of the, I guess, the, it, and that's why it's called Fang Plus, right? It's got some of the top ones.
That makes sense.
And with some of the ones that people think are up and coming, and that list probably keeps changing over time.
Yeah.
You know, stuff can fall off. You know, like, as I said, like Alibaba is interesting. Their total gross merchandise volume is already greater than Amazon. Right, so I mean, it's amazing in that context, right? If and it's pretty much like Amazon in that sense. It's got you know Alipay. It's got a burgeoning, you know, like a web services business or you know, infrastructure as a service business. So you know, it's interesting from that point of view, and you wouldn't get that from Nasdaq. It probably is, you know, the thing. It you have to be comfortable with the fact that you're getting this kind of concentration. So I think that that's the flip side.
Nice one, mate. I like that. Thank you very much, Paul. Hopefully that answers your question in lots of detail. Next one, how long we got? A little bit of time left, I think, mate. So we've got to come for a couple more questions. Question from I've cut the question without putting the name on it. So you know who you are, is all I'll say. G'day, Scott and Doc. Big fan of the podcast. The big four banks except Commonwealth are trading at 8-ish times PE. Is Doc interested yet? There's a laughing face emoji after it. I don't know how you describe laughing face emojis on a podcast, but let's just say it's a laughing face emoji. And a hashtag, get Doc on Insta. You get extra bonus points for using the hashtag. Well done. I wish I could remember who it was that asked this question. I may, while you're answering, Doc, desperately try and find the question on Instagram and see if I can give some credit. But good question. Thank you. Hashtag get Doc on Insta. And the banks are at 8x earnings, mate. Are you buying?
No. So
I have a feeling the question I expected that would be your answer, but tell us why.
Very simple. So one of the interesting things is, and this has not yet played out, and again, I don't want to be the bearer of doomsday type of news, but here's the thing,
sure,
right?
You do.
here's the thing. Exactly as Australian companies, some of the Australian companies are suffering right now because they don't have enough cash on balance sheet and they've got relatively high debt, and they have no cash flow. Some of the companies have a cash flow coming through the doors, and therefore they have to stand down people. Australian households are also in that situation. One of the highest debt to disposable income prior to disposable income actually shrinking.
Yeah.
Right? That puts a lot of pressure on the housing sector, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's a real possibility that stuff will happen in the housing market. So if that happens, well, who bears the brunt of that? That is banks. And definitely, if even if I'm not in on the money on that, there's no growth in the housing market right now. So, you know, they'll have to write off taking payments for, say, the next 6 months. There's going to be increase in bad debt. There'll be people, there'll be investors, for example, who might have to sell or exit. So, for exactly that reason, I think because of the fact that, you know, we are, and I could actually blame policy here. Policy has been to encourage people to borrow as much as you can. Borrow. What can go wrong?
Yeah.
Right? And then when something goes wrong, well, stuff goes wrong. So I think that is really sort of the canary in the coal mine sort of thing. So I'm not touching any of the banks. Now, when I say this, I don't mean the banks are going bust, but I would be an uncomfortable bank shareholder because guess what? If something happens to a bank, depositors are going to be fine.
Right, I
can be sure of that.
Yep.
But shareholders are not going to be
What could possibly
fine.
Go wrong, right?
What exactly. could possibly go wrong? So.
Exactly. All right. Mate, I wasn't asked for my view, but I'm going to give it because, hey, I'm on the podcast too. I tend to agree with you. It's going to be a funny one. You know, that we could have said the same during the GFC and the banks that were stunning performers out of the GFC. They really did lead the market higher in a big, big way. And if you bought in 2009, you made a fortune. But as we know, just because it happened before doesn't mean it won't happen this time. And there is still very much that risk, the economic risk right now. We don't know what that's like. And I'm actually with you on the growth thing. I have a feeling for what it's worth. I'm going to keep this on my radar because if we can get some good economic news and the share prices don't necessarily respond fast enough, at some point there may be the right confluence of events. It just simply makes it too cheap to ignore, even if growth is hard to come by. At 8x earnings, you can get zero growth and still do very, very well. So you know, I mean, I doubt the shares will be that cheap if and when the good news comes, or when the good news comes, it will come. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on, but I kind of agree with you right now. We simply don't know. And these guys are so leveraged. I mean, if you think about all the public comments about, oh, the bank should weigh, give people repayment holidays. They should stop asking for repayments on loans. You know the problem? The banks don't own any of these things. They're the pass-through mechanism for the rest of us who deposit our cash with those banks. And so when you say to people, hey, this bank shouldn't collect the money, don't forget these guys haven't got, you know, war chests that are the same size as their loan books. They've got war chests that are about a tenth of their loan books. And so if one in 10 customers doesn't pay them back, they've got the business is broke. I mean, that, you know, I don't think it's likely, by the way, but that's not impossible. And so when people say, oh, the banks have made all this money, well, they have, but they've paid it out to shareholders as dividends. So there's not that much cash left behind on the balance sheet if and when people demand either banks give people holidays directly or, frankly, people can't pay them back. Just kind of be careful what you wish for, right? Because that is the seeds of potentially some economic destruction that we can avoid by just being a bit more reasonable.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add. So I haven't looked at this number, so this is actually a fascinating thing to look at. Maybe I should. Mm-hmm. What was the leverage in the Australian community?
Yeah.
During the GFC, that's number one. I would bet that leverage has gone up substantially.
Right.
Number two, the thing to look at is in GFC, I think benefited a lot. Australia benefited a lot from Chinese infrastructure spending.
Yeah. That's what kept us out of recession while the rest of the world.
This may not happen this time, right?
Yeah.
So not everything is going to be. I really think, and I see that in the ASX and some of the companies is there has been, I guess, good times for too long. Right. And I think that creates all sorts of issues because the entire system seems very lax and seems ill-prepared to deal with sort of a shock because, again, you know, shocks don't happen, right? Well,
shocks
have not happened, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think that, you know, so so I mean, this is what I call what's happening right now is what I call cascading failures because, you know, why would you cut? Sane. I'll go back to our central bank. No central bank would say, okay, we're all levered up now. Just lever up more because I need spending to grow. Yeah. So I'm going to cut the interest rate before I actually need to cut the interest rate. In hindsight, that was just a really bad decision because what you did is you just continued the levering up process. I'd be cautious again. Yeah, I would be really surprised if. A bank didn't get into trouble this time because, again, as you said, you know, these are highly levered businesses, 1:10,
exactly.
Right? You know, in fact, on a normal day, try getting some cash out of your bank. You know, if you ask for any decent sum of cash, they probably don't have it.
That's right.
They would require 24-hour notice to give you the cash.
Yep.
So,
yeah, the only thing that's going to help the banks in the short term is that with central banks around the world cutting rates so hard, it does give them a bit more headroom on their net margins when this gets difficult on a cash flow basis. But on a pure asset basis, the scary reality for anyone who wants to think this through is the old bank run. If we all went to the bank and wanted our money back now, they couldn't give it to us because they've lent that money to a home loan borrower who can pay it back over 30 years or a credit card borrower who, frankly, can keep the debt as long as they want, as long as they pay the minimum interest. So that's what bank runs are, right? They're when everyone wants their money back, but the bank can't get its money back from its borrowers. Now, I don't want to worry anyone. I'm not suggesting that's likely to happen. It's always possible. It's not likely. But that's the reality of banking, right? For all of these, you know, banks are safe things or the idea that somehow they may be fascinatingly profitable, that kind of great stuff. That's kind of just something to have a think about, that's all I would say. Anyway, that's the story for banks. We're not going to go there just yet, I don't think, Doc. Is that fair to say? Would you?
Yeah.
Are you really at banks altogether? I mean, you've been bearish on banks for a while. Is there a point at which you would buy a bank?
Point at which I would buy a bank is if one or two banks got into trouble,
right?
And then some intervention started,
right?
That's the point at which I would look at, you know, which bank actually looks like it's going to make it through this.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because as I said, I think what's going to happen if something goes wrong, there's going to be a backstop from the government, right? But that doesn't mean that's a backstop for the shareholders. So I'm happy to buy a bank at like a tenth of the price because at that point, from that point on, I would probably make money.
It just
appears like it's not, banks appear safe, people think it is safe, but I would say that you know, this is the type of scenario that nobody would have predicted, right?
Correct,
it's a black swan type of event.
Correct.
And, you know, I just don't think that the banks are prepared for this sort of black swan type of event. So that's my thinking.
The good news is, mate, we get to finish this podcast with another Instagram question and a good other hashtag. How many GetDog and Insta hashtags would you need to join Instagram, mate? For our listeners, because you love our listeners, I know. And I know you don't want to disappoint them. So how many would it take?
I'm just not going to go on to Insta. I would tell people that, you know, if you want to, you know, chat with me, just come on Twitter, because, you know, I still actually have my Facebook account, but I've not gone to Facebook now in over 2 years, I think.
There you go.
I just don't need that much social media.
Don't give up, fellow fools. Keep the hashtag going. All right, last question from Tyler on Instagram. Hi, Scott. Absolutely love the podcast. I, like yourself, like Webjet and really like it at the current market price. Now, this was on Sunday for the record. What I'm struggling with, however, is the scuttlebutt around the stock. A search on Twitter or Facebook gives post after post with scathing reviews. How do you let this sort of thing play into investment decision? I hope you're able to get back to me in some way, either through the mailbag or on here directly. Hashtag GetDoc on Insta. Mate, now, Webjet's in a trading halt. As we record this, they've not been able to raise the capital they wanted, and they're looking at a convertible share offering. So I don't think it's very useful to try and talk about Webjet at the current price, because we simply don't know what the price will be. But I'm going to talk about it if you want to as a business. But what I'm more interested in is the second half of the question from Tyler for our listeners, which is what I'm struggling with is the scuttlebutt around the stock or simply a stock. A search on Twitter or Facebook gives a post after post with scathing reviews. How do you, Doc, let this sort of thing, so, you know, kind of social media scuttlebutt stuff, play into an investment decision?
Okay, and I'll talk a little bit to Webjet as well.
Go for it.
You know, so yeah, we moved Webjet on EO, Extreme Opportunities to Hold. Actually, we just moved it the day before it actually went to, went into suspension, probably a little too late. So Webjet basically is in this position where it needs to raise cash and to basically, you know, survive through this patch. And whoever is going to give them cash is going to basically demand their pound of flesh, a lot of big pound of flesh, which means they're actually going to make money, but it's not, you know, if people, existing shareholders, they're going to be actually on the receiving side. So we just hope that whatever deal they get is a reasonable deal that, you know, if you, over the long term, maybe you make money. But again, we don't know, without knowing the deal, it's really hard to know what's going to happen. So that's my current view on Webjet. Scuttlebutt.
So you're a company out there who everyone's saying, oh, these guys are terrible, these guys are terrible. Are you kind of not buying for that? Are you buying for that? Do you factor it in somehow?
Yeah, so I consider scuttlebutt to some extent, right? But the issue with scuttlebutt, especially with reviews, right? So if for example, there are sites that maintain company reviews.
Yep.
You know, when I say company reviews, they're reviews by employees about the CEO, about the management, and things like that, or about the service, and, you know, it could be just about Webjet and how bad or good they are, right? For example, it is a factor to consider. So, I mean, employee reviews and reviews about management, I think they, and if they're of substantive amount, in the sense that, you know, there are enough, it's just one or two or five or 10 reviews are not enough. But if there are, you know, hundreds of them, then I think they have some meaning and some value, in the sense that they give you a sense of culture in the company and how people think about the business overall. If you're looking at a service, and, you know, let's say you're looking at an online service like Webjet, and you have reviews that says it's terrible, that gives you a sense that people are not happy with the service. However, people might, you could also look at the other thing, which is, you know, do they have traffic growth to the site? Do they have, you know, transaction volume growth to the site?
Right.
And it could be that people are going there because it's cheap, and most of the time you don't need service. And those people who are actually providing comments are the ones that are unhappy, right? And they could just be a small percentage of the total big pie, right? So you got to be a little bit careful with how you treat reviews. So yeah, with a bit of a pinch of salt, I do look at them, but the context really matters. Again, you have to remember that bad reviews, you know, somebody with a bad experience is more likely to review something than somebody with a good experience. I think that's important to remember. So if I had a great experience with Webjet, I probably would not say anything, but if I have a bad experience, I'd probably come and say something. So I think, again, everything is useful, but I think, you know, the extent varies.
Yeah, I like that. I would say almost exactly the same thing, mate. I'm not gonna add a lot more to that because I think it's a really good answer. I tend to trust the numbers rather than the social stuff. To your point, right? I've been on social media for a while. Frankly, I get some lovely feedback on social media. I'm not asking for it, by the way, but I get some lovely feedback. I also get a whole lot of trolling and just crap from people who just, you know, feel like they want to do that. And if I let myself be judged by that, it'd be a different piece of feedback. To Doctor, your point, you know, when people are, you get people comment on things when they have extreme experiences, right? When they love something or hate something. You're never ever going to love an online booking engine. You're just not. Like, it's, and I'm a shareholder, to be really clear. It's a recommendation of ours as well. So just to be clear, so you know where I'm coming from, I'm trying to be biased, but you should always assume that anyone who owns a stock may be at least subconsciously biased, if not absolutely biased. But yeah, if I jump on a website, I mean, so I will give you a different example. Right? I've used appliances online, free plug for them. They have been spectacular. I've used them 3 or 4 times. The experience is fantastic. The booking is, the sale is easy. The service is wonderful. I have absolutely taken part of the Google kind of survey thing they send out because I've just been great. Most other things I use, I just don't bother reviewing because it just, like, it's just a thing, right? Like, it's, you know, I went to Woolies today and I got my groceries and the lady was nice and that was fine. But I'm not going to, didn't actually do it today, by the way. But I'm not going to jump online and go, oh man, that was amazing. It was good. It was exactly what I expect. I was happy to go there. I'll be happy to go back again. I like it. I'm not going to say I'm going to review it. Now, if I have a terrible experience, like, I don't know, I had a bit of a rant about Woolies, just to pick Woolies, a few months ago when they had the, you know, the apples in plastic tubs or something. I was like, guys, do you really need the, you know, excess packaging in this? You know, we're trying to cut down on waste and fossil fuel use, and we're putting one apple in a bloody container. I put that on social media, and that's exactly the example, right? I've been to Woolies hundreds of times. I've never posted, hey, had a great shopping experience today, because it was good. But when something really got on under my nose or under my skin, of course they then went and said, hey, this is, you know, can you guys fix this? So that's the example you should think about when you're looking at Scuttlebutt. The numbers are so much more important. You know, the Scuttlebutt that Peter Lynch used to talk about was actually looking at people shopping there. In other words, you know, are more people going in? Are they buying stuff? Are they liking the experience? That's the Scuttlebutt that kind of matters far more than a sort of cranky reviews by keyboard warriors online. They can be genuine, by the way. I'm not suggesting people are not being genuine. Just, are they actually representative? If they are, great. If they're not, well, there's your answer. Any more for you on that, Doc?
No, I think that's great.
Very good. Fools, if you're looking to buy some stocks right now, and I think you should be, Doc runs a service called Extreme Opportunities. This is an ad, by the way. EO is a wonderful service run by Doc and Kevin. They are trying to find the very best growth companies they can find on the ASX and a couple of ETFs. Are there any ETFs on EO at the moment, mate?
Oh, we've got a couple of ETFs.
There you go. So best stocks, best ETFs, the best investments those guys can find for long-term wealth creation. It is a slightly higher risk, but with the potential of higher return service than some of our others. But if that's up your alley, Doc and Kevin do a fantastic job of combing through the ASX and finding you the very best ideas they can come up with. If you want to join Doc on that journey and Kevin, I would heartily recommend it, partly because I work with them and I know them very well, partly because who doesn't want to make money? And these guys have done a really good job of finding some great companies that I believe over time will do extraordinarily well. You can go to fool.com.au/EO podcast. That's EO for Extreme Opportunities. So that's fool.com.au/EO podcast. And take our special podcast listener price, which is on that webpage. All right, add over. But if you don't join, come on, what are you waiting for? It's too cheap, right?
It is very cheap.
It's really cheap.
It's really cheap.
Seriously, like a couple of bucks a week, something like that?
I know, less than coffee.
I swear to God. Join EO. What have you got to lose? That does wrap us up. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends. We're sure they could use a little foolish straight talk too. And of course, follow us on the socials. Start with Twitter, at Anirban Mahanti is Doc's handle. Mine is at TMF Scott P. Or The Motley Fools is at The Motley Fool AU. Hit us up on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia, or Scott Phillips Money, all one word. Or on Doc's favourite Instagram, at The Motley Fool or at TMF Scott P. Hit us your questions, your comments, your feedback, your thoughts and suggestions. We'd love to hear them. And of course, if you want something on email from us, go straight to fool.com.au/...
Triple M.
Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of Foolish Insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.